But Graham picked up on the acid test format exactly. Both the Fillmore and the Avalon did the prankster's acid test with all the mixed media stuff, the rock and roll and movie projections, and the weird intergalactic amoeba light shows. The Avalon even had it down to details like the strobes and sections of the floor where you could play with Day-Glow paint under black light. Everything but the fourth dimension. Cosmo. The 3 o'clock thing. The experience. The Kairos. They know where it is, but they don't know what it is. Still, the ballrooms were like a big announcement and a front door into the life. The new communal groups themselves were into the pudding. Like the Diggers. Led by a guy named Emmett Grogan, whose hero was Keezy. They went in for pranks. They had a frame of reference, a huge frame 9 feet tall that they set up in the street and asked people to walk through, so we'll all be in the same frame of reference. Then they started handing out free food to all comers, heads, winos, anybody, at 4 p.m. in the panhandle part of the park. The food they cadged from wholesalers and boosted and so on. It was a goddamn sketch, seeing them ladle out the stew every day out of big milk cans. Up at Fulton and Scott is a great shambling old Gothic house, a freaking decayed giant known as the Russian Embassy. A new group called the Calliope Company lives in there, led by Bill Tara, an actor. Many colorful characters like Paul Hawken and Michael Layton, who always wears a Russian Astrakhan hat, and Jack the Fluke, who is a laughing grizzly Irishman with a beard like an Airedale and a cab driver's cap and flapping tweeds bought from the slightly soiled shop. All of them sitting around the great parlor, bare but a glory of old carved wood, 14-foot ceilings. Jack the Fluke tells about his girlfriend Sandra, a teenage girl who just pulled in from Bucks County, Pennsylvania. I come in, and he motions with his head up toward his room on the top floor, and dig, she has a joint rolled this big like a cigar, man, and she's goofing off the radio and puffing on this, I mean, Corona joint and goofing and puffing. It was beautiful. It really takes me back. But of course, the esoteric nostalgia of those first days of discovery, the first little easing open of the doors of the mind with marijuana, and that thing you do at that stage, that goofing off the radio thing, you know? And it's beautiful, the kids beginning to pour into Haight-Ashbury for the life. It's a carnival. The Garden of Eden. One big urban La Honda scene, right out in the open, with all things available. Money is floating around in the air. That's no hassle. Hell, in 3 hours you can pick up $9 or $10 panhandling. Christ, when the straight citizens see a kid in a beard and beads and flowers with a sign around his neck saying, "My heart is prouder than my stomach," it fucking blows their minds and they lay quarters on you. Dollar bills. It's too much. And if worse comes to worse, there is always... "Anybody want a straight job?" says a girl named Jeannie, who lives here at the embassy. Michael Layton says, "Yeah," and it turns out Jeannie is working 3 or 4 hours a night as a topless shoeshine girl in a little shoeshine shack on Broadway in North Beach, and they need a barker outside on the sidewalk to spiel in customers. Michael Layton takes this, yes, straight job, and stands out there at night in a tuxedo and a tall hat, hawking in the dentists who are crawling all over North Beach, panting over the topless. They come inside the shack and climb up on the shoeshine stand and put their feet on the shoeshine stirrups and watch Jeannie's tits dangle and jiggle for 90 seconds while she shines their shoes for $2 and a big lugubrious spade stands by with his hands near a lead beer bottle to smash wise guys and sex fiends with. And they all come out saying the exact same thing. And the funny part is it's a damn good shoeshine. "So I dropped a little acid, like just for the flash, you know," says Michael Layton, "and these two Marines come up. This big sergeant and another one with hash marks on their sleeves like up to here. I'm 8 feet tall by this time, and they're like ants, I'm so stoned. And I yell right in their faces, 'If they stop the war, you guys will be out of a job.' And the sergeant says, 'Yeah?' And man, like it reverses. Now they're 8 feet tall all of a sudden, and I'm an ant. And a very carnival." And it wasn't politics, what he said, just a prank, because the political thing, the whole new left, is all of a sudden like over on the hip circuit around San Francisco, even at Berkeley, the very citadel of the student revolution and all. Some kid who could always be counted on to demonstrate for the grape workers or even do dangerous things like work for Core in Mississippi turns up one day, and immediately everybody knows he has become a head. His hair has the long Jesus Christ look. He is wearing the costume clothes. But most of all, he now has a very tolerant and therefore withering attitude toward all those who are still struggling in the old activist political ways for civil rights, against Vietnam, against poverty, for the free peoples. He sees them as still trapped in the old political games, unwittingly supporting the oppressors by playing their kind of game and using their kind of tactics, while he, with the help of psychedelic chemicals, is exploring the infinite regions of human consciousness. Paul Hawken here in the embassy. In 1965, he was an outstanding activist, sweatshirts and blue jeans and toggle coats, went on the march from Selma, worked as a photographer for CORE in Mississippi, risked his life to take pictures of Negro working conditions, and so on. Now he's got on a great hussar's coat with gold frogging. His hair is all over his forehead and coming around his neck in terrific black Mykonos curls. I take it you aren't too tight with CORE anymore. He just laughs. What about all the things you were involved in last year? All that's changed. You should have seen them leaving for Sacramento. Cal students leaving Berkeley for Sacramento and a demonstration. Yeah, says Tara. It was all fraternity men with sport shirts and crew cuts and their own cars and painted signs, you know, like you get from a commercial artist. There was a lot of bread out there. Yeah, says Tara. And they're all talking about channels. They're going to do this and that through existing channels, or they can't this or that through existing channels. They're all talking about channels. Yeah, says Paul, and shaking their fists. He raises his fist and shakes it in the big Chuck way, and saying, we're off to Sacramento to protest with our dates. It's all changed. It's all a bunch of fraternity men and their Mustangs. A bunch of fraternity men and their Mustangs. In the intellectual hip world of California, there is no more scathing epithet imaginable. A bunch of fraternity men and their Mustangs. Just savor it. Oh, Mario, and Dylan, and Joan Baez. Oh, free speech and anti-Vietnam. Who in his right mind would have ever dreamed it would come to this in 12 months? Abandoned to the supermarket and the breezeway scions. A bunch of fraternity men and Mustangs. And it is, unbelievably, all as the provocateur Kesey has prophesied it, droning on his goddamned harmonica and saying, just walk away and say fuck it. Square hip. Boy Scout Bohemians. And the great rallies at Berkeley that used to pull 10,000 are now lucky to get 1,000. All changed. Even the thing with the spades. All of a sudden the Negroes are out of the hip scene, except for a couple of pushers like Super Spade and a couple of characters like Gaylord and Heavy. The explanation around Haight-Ashbury is that Negroes don't take to LSD. The big thing with spades on the hip scene has always been the quality known as cool. And LSD freaking well blows that whole lead shield known as cool like it brings you right out front, hang-ups and all. Also, the spades don't get much of a kick out of the nostalgia for the mud that all the white middle-class kids who are coming to Haight-Ashbury like, piling into pads and living freaking basic, you understand, on greasy mattresses on the floor that the filthiest spade walk-up in Fillmore wouldn't have, and slopping up soda pop and shit out of the same bottle, just passing it around from mouth to mouth, not being hung up on that old American plumbing and hygiene thing, you understand. Even grokking the weird medieval vermin diseases that are flashing through every groin. Crab lice. You know that thing, man, where you first look down at your lower belly and see these little scars? They look like little scabs or something. Tiny little mothers. And like you pick one, root it out, and it starts crawling. Oh, shit. And then they're all crawling, and you start exploring your mons pubis and your balls, and they're alive. It's like a jungle you never saw before, in your own crotch, your own shag. And it's alive, a freaking bestiary, in fact. The little bastards, like soft-shell crabs that could dance on the head of a pin. And you keep picking them off, but every time you look, you see 8 more creeping over the veld and the savannas, and you practically go blind staring at the little Africa down there between your legs, and it's A200 time, man, A200. Pyrenaic liquid, the only solution, that little green bottle, man, do you remember? And so on. Nostalgia for the mud. The life. Even down in a place like La Jolla in North San Diego, the poshest resort on the Pacific beaches, T, one of the great young surfers, turns up one day with a 3-wheel trunk motorcycle, the kind drugstore delivery boys use, and he pulls up into one driveway after another, and the kids come out and help yourself. And he's got every pill and capsule you ever imagined, plus lids of grass, and the life is on. Even devoted surfing cliques like the Pump House Gang, the Mysterioso C and all that, are easing into the life. And some move up the beach from the Pump House, away from the everlasting sets of good surfing waves they used to wait for like Phrygian sacristans. Up from the Pump House to the parking lot. where they sit in cars with special amethyst-tinted windows and grok in fullness the Pacific sun as it comes through the weird glass, and the cops wonder what in hell they're doing in cars all day instead of being on the beach. And they rouse them and search the cars and find nothing but warn, "We know you kids are drinking beer out here." Beer! One of the pump house gang leaders, Artie, pulls into Haight-Ashbury because this is the underground word in the life in all the high schools in California already, even though Haight-Ashbury has never been mentioned in the newspapers. Haight-Ashbury. They know the whole new legend right down to Owsley, now known as the White Rabbit, the paranoid acid genius. Artie pulls into Haight-Ashbury, walking along amid those endless staggers of bay windows, slums with a view, and who is sitting out on a curbing on Haight Street but Jay of Pump House Days Gone By, just sitting there with an Emporium shopping bag beside him. "Hi, Jay." Jay just barely glances at him and says, "Oh, hi, Artie," as if naturally they're both in Haight-Ashbury and have been for years, and then he says, "Here, have a lid." And he reaches in the shopping bag and just offers him a whole lid of grass, free, out in the open. Artie looks up Anchovy's communal pad. Anchovy, who was little known in La Jolla in the old surfing days, he wasn't a surfer, is now a beautiful person and a good shepherd in Haight-Ashbury for all the La Jolla kids up here. Artie makes the rounds in Haight-Ashbury, and it's a carnival. Everybody working for the management in wondrous ways, popping Owsley LSD up from out of Pez candy dispensers, smoking grass, taking methadrine and fucking, and carrying on wherever and whenever they feel like it on the streets, practically. Later, Anchovy has love-ins called Trans Love Airways going on the San Diego campus of the university. And everybody is freaking out on the grass to the loudest rock and roll in history and smoking grass in a goddamned green cloud, for Christ's sake, and taking movies of it all for the archives. And they're allied now with real people, good people, a motorcycle band known as the Pallbearers, the local version of the Hell's Angels. And Artie leans up against a tree smoking a fake joint rolled of plain Bull Durham tobacco because you got to look like you're into the thing at all times. But in fact, it is getting to be too much. About 9 different constabularies stage a mass raid to wipe out the dope plague from the San Diego County High Schools, and they pounce on La Colonia Tijuana, which means the Tijuana slums, name here in La Jolla underground for the apartments a lot of people in the life share this summer near the beach. And some good pump house souls are busted, but that is the life, the world, divided into surfer heads and suffer lames. Besides, it was a laugh and a half, the look on the cops' faces, when they saw the ceilings of La Colonia Tijuana, canopied in huge laceworks of interlocked pop-top rings off beer cans, billowing in such groovy, silvery ripples of grockable reflections. The probation generation, not the lost generation or the beat generation or the silent generation or even the flower generation, but the probation generation, with kids busted right and left up and down the coast for grass, and all get off the first time on probation. What's probation? With this millennium at hand, and it is, because there's no earthly stopping this thing. It's like a boulder rolling down a hill. You can watch it and talk about it and scream and say, "Shit," but you can't stop it. It's just a question of where it's going to go. Right now, there are 2 ways it can go in Haight-Ashbury. One is the Buddhist direction, the Leary thing. There are good heads like Michael Bowen and Gary Goldhill who want to start the League for Spiritual Discovery here and pull the whole movement together into one church and give it a focus and even legal respectability. And they have given up much for this dream. Goldhill is a beautiful head. He is an Englishman who was writing this experimental stuff for TV in England, and the BBC sent him to the U.S. to apply for a big grant, a Guggenheim or something. And he took a vacation in Mexico and ran into some American heads in San Miguel de Allende who said, "Man, you gotta come back here when the rainy seasons start and take some magic mushrooms." And damned if they didn't send him a telegram in Guadalajara or wherever. Rains came, mushrooms up. And he returned out of curiosity and took the mushrooms, just as Leary had, and discovered the management and gave up all the TV BBC game, and dedicated himself to the life. And Bowen has an apartment with India print spreads lining the walls, and couches on the floor, and handmade Indian teapots and cups, and 3 small crystals suspended from the ceiling by almost invisible threads, and picking up lights like jewels in the air. A place devoid of all the shit and gadgetry of the modern American plastic life, For, as Leary has said, a home should be a place of purity that the Gautama Buddha himself could walk into from 485 BC and feel at home. For someday grass must grow again in the streets in pastoral purity, for life is shit, a duress of bad karmas, endless fight against catastrophe, which is to be warded off finally only by utter purification of the soul, utter passivity in which one becomes nothing, but a vessel of the all one. As against the Kesey direction, which has become the prevailing lifestyle of Haight-Ashbury, beyond catastrophe, like picking up on anything that works and moves, every hot wire, every tube, ray, volt, decibel, beam, floodlight, and combustion of American flag-flying neon day-glow America, and winding it up to some mystical extreme carrying to the westernmost edge of experience. The day was coming, but the movement lacked a single great charismatic leader, a visionary who could pull the whole thing together. Leary was too old, heading toward 50 years old, and too remote somehow, holed up in Millbrook, New York. As for Kesey, he is swamp-bound in exile in some alligator-infested Mexican hideaway, it was presumed. Yet here come the merry pranksters pulling back into San Francisco from Mexico via their own route. The Calliope Company gives them their warehouse on Harriet Street to live in for a month, a place Tara wants to turn into a theater, an old garage in an abandoned hotel in the Tenderloin, where Jack Dempsey used to train in a special amphitheater with a sloping wooden floor, now all fully claimed by the vermin and the winos. But colored power and the Dayglo bus and the pranksters come rolling in, and good heads start gathering around in the Dayglo gloom of the place, like the telepathic kid who gets unspoken messages. We need beds. And he climbs a ladder and starts rigging the platforms on the theater scaffolding in here. As the pranksters assemble from all over, Hermit, back from dark adventures in Napa Valley, Stuart Brand and Lois Jennings, back from the Southwest, Paul Foster, back from India, all joining the veteran Mexican band, Cassidy, Babs, Gretch, Mountain Girl, Fay and the Children, Ramrod, Hagen, Page, Doris DeLay, Zonker, Black Mariah. And all at once it dawns, the main truth, spreading over the jungle drums all over the Haight-Ashbury. Kesey himself is back to the man. Such was the background of the underground summit meeting between Kesey and Owsley. It was as crazy a scene as anybody ever dreamed up. For a start, it was in the apartment of Margot St. James, which looks like she once read a historical novel about a Roman banquet. The meeting began to shape up as a debate. Owsley, the white rabbit, was sitting over here, and Kesey, the fugitive, was sitting over there. Owsley was dressed like an uptown head. Long hair, a dueling shirt with billowing sleeves, a sleeveless jacket, and beads, amulets, mandalas hanging down over his chest, tight pants and high boots. Kesey had on his buckskin shirt and tight ginger corduroy pants and the Guadalajara red prankster boots, and he was in a chuckling, giggling mood. Standing around, along with Margot, were various pranksters, Haight-Ashbury heads, San Francisco State heads, Berkeley heads, and two or three Hell's Angels, including Terry the Tramp. Kesey presents his theory of going beyond acid. You find what you came to find when you're on acid, and we've got to start doing it without acid. There's no use opening the door and going through it and then always going back out again. We've got to move on to the next step. This notion has Owsley slightly freaked, naturally. He has his voice wound all the way up. Bullshit, Kesey, it's the drugs that do it. It's all the drugs, man. None of it would have happened without the drugs, and so forth. Kesey keeps cocking his head to one side and giggling in the upcountry manner and saying, "No, it's not the drugs. In fact," chuckle, giggle, "I'm going to tell everyone to start doing it without the drugs," and so forth. People in the room start following this exchange like a tennis match, the heads batting this way and that. One unfortunate kid from San Francisco State happens to get into this state of obsession about 1 foot in front of Terry the Tramp. He keeps edging closer and batting his head around and edging in closer until he is standing in front of Terry the Tramp and cutting off his line of vision, which is bad enough, but then he has to take out a cigarette and light it, all of this practically in Terry the Tramp's face, or within a couple feet of it, which is all the same to Terry. One billow comes up from the kid's cigarette, and Terry the Tramp says, "Hey, man, how about a cigarette?" He says it with a tone you have to hear to fully comprehend. It is the patented Hell's Angels tone of soft, grinning menace, kind of like the tone the second-story man uses on the watchdog. Come here, fella, so I can squash your head with this brick. He says it's soft, but it stops the whole room like high noon. Hey, man, how about a cigarette? The kid smells debacle in the air. It registers from his solar plexus to his earthworm lips. But he hasn't quite figured out what it's all about. He just hurries into his shirt pocket and takes out the cigarettes and shakes one free and offers it to Terry the Tramp, who takes it and puts it in his pocket. Then he says, with the soft grin menace smile snaking up out of his beard, "How about another one?" The kid mumbles okay and fishes into his pocket and shakes loose another cigarette, and Terry the Tramp takes it and puts it into his pocket. The kid, meantime, is frozen like a rabbit frozen by the eye-beams of a cougar. He knows it is time to split, but he can't move. He is stricken stiff and fascinated by his own impending destruction. It's like there is nothing to do but play out the sequence. He puts the cigarettes back in his pocket, and precisely then, naturally, comes again the milky atropine. How about another one? Okay. And Terry the Tramp takes another one, and the kid puts them back in his pocket, and Terry the Tramp says, "How about another one?" Okay. And Terry the Tramp takes another one, and now every eye in the room watches the rabbit and the snake, panting for the next broken hyoid bone. How many cigarettes does the kid have left, fans? 8? 10? And what then, after all the cigarettes are gone? How about your shirt? Okay. How about your boots? Okay. How about your pants? Okay. And now your hide, mother. My hide? Your very hide, mother. Your very ass. The last vestige of your pride and honor. March! And his bones crunched like baked baby ortolans. Everyone in the room can see the entire movie in an instant, like some crucible of the prison brutes, Terry the Tramp slowly picking meat off the turkey. Fascinating. Stay tuned in for next week's Broken Hyoid Bone. Until a couple of pranksters intervene with overtones of "He's just a baby, Terry, don't snuff him." So the Kesey-Owsley debate resumed. It was a small moment. No heads were broken. Certainly the angels have done worse. The kid even got away that night with a whole half a pack of cigarettes. Yet it stuck in the throat. One way or another, the Hell's Angels came to symbolize the sight of the Kesey adventure that panicked the hip world. The angels were too freaking real. Outlaws. They were outlaws by choice from the word go all the way out in Edge City. Further, the hip world, the vast majority of the acid heads, were still playing the eternal charade of the middle-class intellectuals. Behold my wings, freedom, flight. But you don't actually expect me to jump off that cliff, do you? It is the eternal game in which Clement Attlee, bald as Lenin, lively as a toy tank, yodels blood to the dock workers of Liverpool, and dies buried in striped pants with a magenta sash across his chest and a coin with the Queen's likeness upon each eyelid. In their heart of hearts, the heads of Haight-Ashbury could never stretch their fantasy as far out as the Hell's Angels. Overtly, publicly, they included them in. Suddenly, they were the raw, vital proles of this thing, the favorite minority replacing the spades. Privately, the heads remained true to their class and to its visceral panics. One trouble with this Kesey was, he really meant it. But, step up the movie. He suddenly turned up one afternoon at Ed McClanahan's creative writing class at Stanford. He sticks his head in the door and smiles from underneath a cowboy hat and says, "Happy birthday, Ed." In truth, it is his birthday. Then he comes on in, the fugitive in buckskin shirt and red Guadalajara boots. Tells the students why he wants to move beyond writing to more electric forms. Then vanishes, that damned Pimpernel. Then the Haight-Ashbury heads held the first big be-in, the Love Festival on October 7th, on the occasion of the California law against LSD going into effect. Thousands of heads piled in high costume, ringing bells, chanting, dancing ecstatically, blowing their minds one way and another, and making their favorite satiric gesture to the cops, handing them flowers, burying the bastards in tender, fruity petals of love. Oh, Christ, Tom, the thing was fantastic, a freaking mind-blower. Thousands of high-loving heads out there messing up the minds of the cops, and everybody else in a fiesta of love and euphoria. And who pops up in the middle of it all, down in the panhandle strip of the Golden Gate Park, but the Pimpernel, in Guadalajara boots and cowboy suit, and just as the word gets to ricocheting through the crowd real good, "Kesey's here, Kesey's here," he vanishes, accursed Pimpernel. Just in case there was anybody left who didn't get the gestalt here, Kesey made his big move in the press. He met with Donovan Bess, a reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, and gave him the story of his flight to Mexico and his plans as the fugitive. The story was a real barn burner. Secret interview with fugitive wanted by FBI, with all the trimmings, awash in screamers all across the San Francisco Chronicle. The line that captured all imaginations was where Kesey said, "I intend to stay in this country as a fugitive and as salt in J. Edgar Hoover's wounds." Then, this next prank was beautiful. A TV interview. The fugitive on TV, while all, FBIs and everyone, watch helpless as the full face of the fugitive, Kesey, beams forth into every home and bar and hospital and detective bureau in the Bay Area. It was beautiful even to think about this prank. It was set up, much sly planning, with Roger Grimsby, a San Francisco television personality, on station KGO, the local CBS outlet. The fantasy was that Grimsby would tape an interview with Kesey in a hideaway in the Portuero section of San Francisco, which was far away from both Haight-Ashbury and North Beach, and then put it on the air a couple of days later, October 20th, a Friday. This fantasy came off like a dream. Grimsby taped the interview, and all was cool. And on Friday afternoon, Kesey's face beamed into every home, bar, hospital, and detective bureau, saying it all again in person, "I intend to stay in this country as a fugitive and as salt in J. Edgar Hoover's wounds. See the very hunted coons salt J. Edgar Hoover's wounds. Yeah, the cops and robbers game." All that remains to be done is the grand finale. Fugitive extraordinaire. In this fantasy, Kesey will present himself in person, in the flesh. Kesey, only inches away from the greatest collection of cops in the history of the drug scene, and then vanish like Mandrake. The pranksters will hold a monster trips festival, the acid test of all times, the ultimate on Halloween, in San Francisco's largest hall, Winterland, for all the heads on the West Coast, or coast to coast and galaxy to galaxy. Naturally, the cops will converge on this hideous bacchanal to watch for Kesey and other felons and bad actors. But, of course, an integral part of the fantasy. It will be a masked ball, this test. Nobody will know which freak is who. At the midnight hour, Kesey, masked and disguised in a superhero costume, on the order of Captain America of the Marvel Comics pantheon, will come up on stage and deliver his vision of the future, of the way beyond acid. Who is this apocalyptic? Then he will rip off his mask. Why, it's Ken Kesey! And as the law rushes for him, he will leap up on a rope hanging down from the roof at center stage and climb, hand over hand, without even using his legs, with his cape flying straight up, 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 through a trap door in the roof, to where Babs will be waiting with a helicopter, Captain Midnight of the U.S. Marines, and they will ascend into the California ozone, looking down one last time into the upturned moon faces of all the put-on, nonplussed, outwitted, befuddled, befreaked, shucked, constables and sleuths. Yeah, yeah, right, right, right. Right, 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 right. An even world, 25 minutes after the Grimsby TV show Friday afternoon, October 20th, Kesey and Hassler driving out of San Francisco on the Harbor Freeway toward Palo Alto in an old red panel truck. The current fantasy. This movie is too real, Mommy. But they have actually pulled it off. They have just been in town in the hideaway watching Kesey the Fugitive on TV, and this prank was too beautiful. The FBI and all cops everywhere shucked in the most public, galling way. The sun slants down on the Harbor Freeway in the afternoon, and all the shiny black shoe multitudes are out in their 300-horsepower fantasy cars heading into the rush hour, out the freeway, toward the waiting breezeway slots. It's actually peaceful, this rush hour. We pulled it off. Thousands of cars sailing up the swooping expressway like so many salt-flat futuromatics with taillight bands like hard red candy. It's relaxing, the rush hour is, and hypnotic. It drones, and it winks like red hard candy with the sun shining through it, and the sun shines in Kesey's side of the panel truck, very relaxing. And he takes off his disguise, the cowboy hat and dark glasses. See the very hunted coons salt J. Edgar Hoover's wounds. Hassler, driving, vaguely aware of the cars floating by in the rush hour, shiny hulls with so many shaved globes sticking up inside. K. Keezy. Suddenly, coming up on his left, Hassler sees a car full of shiny haircut faces, jammed full of them, all staring at them, Hassler and Keezy. And now gray Illumicron arms flapping out the window, stabbing and motioning, pull over, much grimacing and shouting soundlessly into the slipstream of the rush hour, and one with his wallet dangling out the window, flapping his badge at them. Run, split, vanish. But there is no place to vanish to. It is all clear in a flash, trapped in the rush hour for a start, and the panel truck can't outrun their sedan anyway. Opposite side pickoff. Hassler tries to squeeze between cars and lose them that way, like a basketball play, but it's no use. The cops keep floating abreast, grimacing and flapping and drifting back and pulling even again. There. Keezy motions to the shoulder of the expressway by an embankment, and Hassler cuts over there, skids to a stop. Thrash. Keezy out the door and plunges over the guardrail and down the embankment with the dust flying. Hassler just sits there as the sedan skids to a stop in front of him, cutting him off. Seems like 20 doors fly open, haircut faces and gray Illumicron bodies popping out in every direction, leaping over the guardrail. All in shiny black shoes. One orders Hassler out of the panel truck, and Hassler gets out and sits down on the edge of the freeway. Very strange. The great swarm of cars with hard candy tails keeps sailing past, hypnotically. Hassler gets into the lotus position, sitting cross-legged on the asphalt, looking straight ahead. Three sets of shiny black FBI shoes standing around him now. They all have these shiny black shoes on. Then one of them goes back to the sedan and comes back with a flare gun and stands over him with that. Hassler wonders if he intends to shoot him with a flare. A very Dayglo death. Thread soul, the causal body, ablation, Upanishads, Krishnamurti, the karmic vestiture of the soul, the nirvanic consciousness. It all runs together right here, like a tinned stew, and Hassler isn't even high. On the other side of the expressway, on the edge of the bay, great fat seagulls are wheeling in the air in a great weird O pattern, coasting down below the level of the highway, then struggling up, dripping garbage out of their gullets, but a nice pattern all in all. The visitation drain. It's the visitation drain they've picked to work out their karma in. Ah, we're synced up this afternoon. And the gulls wax fat, gulping garbage at the drain, and grease a slippery fat O in the sky, and it occurs to Hassler that today is his 27th birthday. Skidding down the embankment, chalking up dust like in a western, the blur of the drain flats out beyond. Keezy vaults over an erosion fence at the bottom of the embankment. Rip! A picket catches his pants in the crotch, rips out the inseams of both pants legs most neatly, flapping on his legs like low-rent cowboy chaps, running and flapping through the visitation flats. Poor, petered-out, suck-muck, marginal housing development, last blasted edge of land you can build houses on before they just sink into the ewes and the compost. Poor visitation drain kids playing ball in the last street before the ewes runs flapping through their ball game stare at him. And at the ghost on my heels? Like the whole world turn into an endless kids' ball game on the edge of the ooze, thousands of drain kids furling toward the horizon like an urchin funnel. And that Illumicron blur behind me? Shiny black shoes tusking up behind him stops stuck still in the visitation drain and, gotcha, in the cops and robbers game. Chapter 27. The Graduation. The Last Chapter. They have Keezy on three felonies. The original conviction in San Mateo County for possession of marijuana, which he never served time on. The arrest for possession in San Francisco, after which he fled to Mexico. And a federal charge of unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. A felon and a fugitive, who, yes, was going to rub the FBI's nose in it for good measure. And all about dope at that. And throw away the key. For 3 days they shuttle Keezy back and forth between county and federal courthouses and jails in Redwood City and San Francisco. It will take a miracle to even get him out on bail, an inspiration, a vision. A vision. We can work it out. Keezy's lawyers, Pat Hallinan, Brian Rowan, and Paul Robertson, have a vision. The next morning they're in the courtroom in Redwood City at a bail hearing. The new style of courtroom modern, this courtroom, all great lineless slabs of blonde wood and low slung like the friendly banks of the suburbs, all very sunny under the fluorescent tubes. Keezy sits at the defense table wearing a blue work shirt. Robertson is on his feet telling the judge about a certain vision Mr. Kesey has had of beyond acid, an inspiration, a miracle, a light he has seen, although never mind the details of the beach in Manzanillo, not those lights. In any case, Mr. Kesey has a very public-spirited plan. He has returned voluntarily from exile in his safe harbor to risk certain arrest and imprisonment in order to call a mass meeting of all LSD takers, past, present, and potential, for the purpose of telling them to move beyond this pestilent habit of taking LSD. Robertson's talking a streak. It's a grand speech. Kesey is sitting up straight at the table, staring blue bolts at the judge. But Robertson's words are like a fog. Kesey disappears in the soup. He reappears in a mist, undergoing metamorphosis before your very eyes. He's found religion, contrition, redemption, the error of his ways, and now he's going to tell the youth his sad lesson. Fay and the kids are in the audience. Also many of their old Perry Lane friends, Jim and Dorothea Fadiman, Ed McClanahan, Jim Waltman, and some others. Several will stake their homes as bail security, $35,000 worth. Repentance and redemption are sailing around the courtroom like cherubim. All us reporters are scribbling away. Now Kesey is standing up facing the judge with his arms folded, and the judge is giving him a lecture. He may be a great literary lion and a romantic figure to some misguided youth, but to this court he is a childish ass, an egotist who never grew up, The judge is pouring it down his throat like cod liver oil. But it's obvious it's just a build-up to saying he's going to grant bail anyway under the circumstances. Nevertheless, Kesey is burning. You can see him setting his jaw and getting ready to move his lips. God knows Hallinan and Robertson can see it. They're crouched beside him like bandits. The first peep out of him, they're going to grab him around the throat. Keep your mouth shut, damn it! Don't blow it now. It's only cod liver oil. But the judge has finished, and it's over. He's out on bail in San Mateo County. The whole dam breaks after that. The FBI drops the federal charge of unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. All of a sudden, they don't seem very interested in the case, despite the salt in J. Edgar Hoover's wounds and the rest of it. Then, back in San Francisco, when Kesey is standing in front of the judge in a faded sports shirt, work pants, and boots. The judge has a terrific speech ready, saying this case has been blown up out of proportion in the press, and it is only a common dope case as far as he is concerned, and Kesey is no dragon, just an ordinary jackass. And Kesey is starting to say something, and Hallinan and Rowan are crouched for the garrote, but again it's over, and Kesey is out on bail in San Francisco, too. It's unbelievable. He's out after only 5 days. In the San Francisco jail, before he got out on bail, Kesey met a kid with magic fingernails. Take a lick, said the kid. And everybody did. They all licked his nails and blew their lids. 27 psyches going off like Nike missiles through the lye-scoured concrete skyways of the San Francisco jail. The kid had LSD on his magic fingernails. Now, Kesey told this story to the local news reporters who pressed around him in the courtroom after the hearing on his bail, just to prove how hopeless was the drive to stamp out dope with things like cops and jails. Try and stop a kid with magic fingernails. The headline said, LSD orgy in the San Francisco jail. Ah, certain local heads cried Judas. Thinked on a stash, this Judas, while he himself so shrewdly copped out of jail on bail. A thinking fingernail stash betrayal. If the truth be known, these good hearts flapped in fibrillation. They feared the rogue vibrations from the freaking acid graduation Kesey and the pranksters planned. Their freaking day-glow last roundup in Winterland. Can't you see it coming? 10,000 children of the flowers and grass and acid, speed and poppers, yellow jackets, amyl nitrate. 10,000 heads, freaks, beats, hippy-dippies, teeny boppers descending from the crest of Hate Street, tinkling temple bells, rattling, donkey beads, reeking, grass, shuffling, elf boots, swarming prostrate before the returning prophet in the bowels of Winterland. All of Psychedelphia moaning to the polyphonic droning of the Merry Prankster Band. It's too easy for this headline-blazing superhero, this amazing Cagliostro Elmer Gantry Dayglow Nero. On the top floor of the Russian embassy, in an extremely crummy brown room, it looks inflammable or spontaneous combustible, the next cough maybe, and it's all up in here. Jack the Fluke sits up in bed, namely, a mattress on the floor with his back against the wall, wearing nothing except his cabbie's cap and the grizzle on his face and the grizzle on his camembert chest. A brown blanket pulled up to his waist. Take a look at that. If you want to know about Kesey, a large message tacked up on the wall on a sheet of drawing paper. Dear Ken, the boys in the tank say hello. They want to know about their money. Should they ask you or the judge or who? Sandra, the girl from Bucks County, sits in a clump at the foot of the mattress. She is a very pale, tender little teenage clump. A single morsel, gone at one gulp, sitting under the room's one article of furniture, a bridge lamp, no longer goofing off the radio, just sitting in a teenage clump and listening to Jack tell me about the letter. Oh, man, there were a lot of good heads hassled and busted after Kesey told about that. You mean the cops? The very ones. It was a bad scene, like there's a lot of cats up here who are not enchanted with Ken Kesey. They sent him this letter. Well, obviously they haven't, because there it is up on the wall, but the thought is there. Creaks on the inflammable stairs, and into the room sidles a dark little guy in a t-shirt and jeans carrying a round plastic box of cheese spread and a knife in a scabbard. Jack, he says in this weird whisper. One of those long knives with a lot of fancy mother-of-pearl on the handle that you see in a Chinatown souvenir shop. It was a bad scene, Jack the Fluke tells me. He ignores the guy. Jack, look at this, says the kid. That's nice, Frenchie, says Jack. Jack, it's beautiful, says Frenchie. Like there's a lot of cats up here, Jack says to me again. It's beautiful, says Frenchie. Jack, you know where there's any morphine? No, says Jack, then resumes. Like there's a lot of cats up here. It's a beautiful thing, says Frenchie. Who are not enchanted with Ken Kesey, and they sent him this letter. Jack! And Frenchie hunkers down on the floor and opens the cheese spread and pulls the knife out of the scabbard and sinks the blade into it. Quite a blade, a foot long and engraved with Chinese demons. He wipes gobs of cheese spread onto his tongue with the blade. Sandra sits silent in a clump, grooving on the full life. Jack raps on about perfidy in high places. I don't know what the reference to money is. They want to know about their money. But the gist of it is clear enough. Kesey has sold out to keep from getting a 5-year sentence or worse. Next he'll nail it down by calling all the kids to Winterland and telling them to stop taking LSD. Freaking cop out. It's quite a mess for Kesey, of course. If he had lectured back at the judges like a superhero, that would have been the end of everything, probably, with him salted away for many years. On the other hand, if he just stares back orientally as the current fantasy of Beyond Acid is put forth, he looks like a cop-out in Haight-Ashbury. All those good-loving heads. They've been having quite a time for themselves. A summer of euphoria. The millennium, in fact. LSD and hundreds of beautiful people already on the scene and no more little games. They would just spread out like a wave over the world and end all the bullshit, drown it in love and awareness, and nothing could stop them. I'll have to hand it to the heads. They really want to end the little games. Their hearts are pure. I never found more than one or two cynics or hustlers among them. But now that the moment is at hand, everyone is wondering, who is going to lead the way and hold the light? Then just one little game starts known as politics. As I say, their hearts are pure. Nevertheless, Chet Helms and the family dog have their thing. Bill Graham has his thing. The Grateful Dead have theirs. The Diggers have theirs. The Calliope Company have theirs. Bowen has his. Even Gary Goldhill. It's a little like the socialist movement in New York after World War I. The revolution is imminent, as all know and agree. And yet, Christ, everybody and his brother has a manifesto. The Lovestonites, the Dubinsky Socialists, the CPUSA, Bolshevik, the Wobblies. Everybody has his own typewriters and mimeograph machines, and they're all cranking away like mad and fuming over each other's mistranslations of the message. Not that the heads in Haight-Ashbury are wrangling with each other yet, but what do they do about Kesey? Just sit back and let him and the pranksters do their thing? Let them try to turn a lot of impressionable kids off LSD the way the newspapers say he intends? Or let him suddenly make a big power play at Winterland and take over the whole movement? Politics, in a word. And the pranksters, by and by. I find them in the Calliope garage on Harriet Street, the old garage, the ex-pie factory in the bottom of the old hotel. I kept peeking around in the crazy gloom of the place amid all the scabbard wood and sour corners and ratty blankets and scaffoldings and beat-up theater seats and the luminous bus hulking in its own grease, and the rotting mattresses where people stretched out and slept, and the shell station up on the corner where everyone copped urinations. And I couldn't figure out what they had to be so exultant about. It beat me. As I looked back on it, they were all trying to tell me, Hassler with his discourse on the world full of games and futile oppositioning, and how the pranksters meant to show the world how to live, with his toothbrush case shimmering. He was a kind man. He was trying to give me the whole picture at once. It wasn't about cops and robbers in Mexico. It was about pranksters arriving from far and wide. The old schism forgotten. Paul Foster back from India, looking emaciated, his mustache and mutton chops gone, his head shaved, but with the great god Rotor roaring and digging away.